Gators Breakdown, because there's never a dull moment in Gator Nation.
The Gators Breakdown podcast is ready to go. I am your host, David Waters, and you can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. And joining me for the first time in quite a while is Will Miles. Will, we got together for our championship rewind of the 2008 game a couple weeks ago, but I was on vacation 1 week, had some other stuff lined up, just, you know, gave you some time off.
Yeah, well, you know, we all got to see you going down that slide there on Twitter for while the recruits are coming in, Dave. So there seems to be a split among the fan base as to whether that's the appropriate picture where we get a commit or whether we stick with the Mullen picture. I'm going to go with the Mullen picture, but, you know, use your judgment based on the quality of the recruit.
Yeah, I think I have figured out maybe what we'll do. I'll say if it's an offensive recruit, I'll do the Dan Mullen picture. If it's a defensive recruit, I'll do the slide.
A lot of slides this year.
Yeah, a lot of good slides. How was the time off?
Oh, it was good, man. I mean, you know, it's not really time off. It's just evenings to myself every once in a while. So that's always good. And, you know, weather's starting to break a little bit here and get a little bit cooler. We had the hurricane come through yesterday. So, managed not to float away, and we're doing well.
Everything, health-wise, everything going good?
Yeah, everything's good. We got, you know, we got our challenges just like everybody else. But, you know, at the end of the day, like I said, there are people who have it worse than us up here. At the Schuylkill River down here in downtown Philly was flooding this morning. So luckily I'm a little bit ways from there and didn't have to deal with any of that.
Will, let our listeners know you've had a lot going on at Read and Reaction the last couple weeks or so. So a lot of articles out there. Give our listeners a preview of what they can find on the site.
Yeah, so we had our old friend Bill Sykes come back, and he talked a little bit about recruiting and the guys from Palmetto High School and what that would mean to Florida's class. Though obviously that's at least recently been a little bit disappointing. And then
we'll get into that.
And then I had an article up about recruiting as well. And then we. You know, with all the stuff going on with the We Are United at for the Pac-12, and certainly some of the Florida players getting involved with that too. I had Jordan Dorman, a former basketball player at Florida, come on the site and talk a little bit about what it's like to be an athlete at University of Florida. I thought it was pretty interesting. And then the Give Him Hell Pell series continues with Nick Knudsen. He's done a really good job. Recently was looking at sort of the impact that Charlie Pell had on the program back in the 80s and sort of his lasting legacy within the Florida program. Some of the stuff that he did with the booster programs that still exists today. It's a really interesting read. It's actually my favorite one in the series thus far. So there's still a few more of those to come, and those are going to be coming out in the next few days as well.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Like I said, we've been busy. Gators Breakdown, Championship Rewind, those two games. That was a lot of fun, hanging out with some fellow fans and reliving the 06-08 championship games. A lot of fun there on Channel 4, the local station there. So hopefully we get to do some stuff like that again in the future. Hopefully that won't be the only game we get to watch as a fan base together with some people out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was kind of fun. I was sitting there going, I wonder if this is how Alabama fans feel right now. Because watching that 2008 game, it was like, we're invincible. We're going to win the next six championships. Meyer has two more number one classes coming in. And 2008 was the peak, right? And yeah. And the 09 team was good, but obviously didn't get the job done against Alabama. And then in 2010, the wheels really started to fall off. And you know, you sort of hope that's probably you hope that's coming with Alabama. You hope that's coming with Georgia over the next couple of years. And we sort of see that same type of thing. But certainly, you know, more than anything, I think we just all hope we get to see football this year. And with some of the changes that have been going on with each of the conferences and the SEC included, it's going to be an interesting year and a different year, but hopefully a good year for everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So as kind of Will alluded to, we'll get into there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of stuff to get into here on this episode of Gators Breakdown. We'll get into the SEC. We'll look at the 10-game schedule again. I was supposed to be on vacation last week, but I knew that was going to drop. So, yeah, little back and forth episode with you guys out there that I dropped last week when we found out about the 10-game schedule. So Will and I, I'll get Will's thoughts on the 10-game schedule. We'll talk about Kamarvo Coxon reclassifying and being a 2020 commit or recruit and being on campus hopefully in a couple of weeks and some recruiting news as well. But before we get to all that, remember you can find Gators Breakdown on news4jax.com/GatorsBreakdown. There you'll find all the Gators Breakdown episodes and news for Jack's coverage of the Gators. Please share, rate, and review the show. Subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. And follow Gators Breakdown on social media, on Twitter and Facebook at Gators Breakdown. So, Will, we are one reason we're coming to you live on a Wednesday night on YouTube. We tried to wait as long as we could before for the SEC to release the schedule. As I said last week, we all know the 10-game schedule. SEC conference only schedule was released last week for the SEC. The Big Ten released their games on Wednesday today here. So I was hoping the SEC would do their part and release the schedule for us. So the whole episode would have pretty much been about that. But yeah, I know it will probably be tomorrow, and you'll get two Gators Breakdown episodes this week if that's the case. But they couldn't help us out and give it to us Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. So we'll. 10-game SEC schedule. We still don't know the two opponents. The eight SEC opponents from the regular schedule are still set. That'll still be eight of the opponents for the Gators. Still awaiting two opponents for the Gators. But what's your thoughts on, generically, a 10-game SEC conference-only schedule?
I mean, normally I would love it, right? Because it means that you're getting unbelievable football for 11 straight weeks. I'm assuming there's going to be a bye week in there, maybe two bye weeks in there.
Yeah, but one in the middle and one at the end if they have to make up a game.
Yeah, so you're going to get an unbelievable slate of games, right? There are going to be good games on every week. And, you know, you get that game sort of right before the Florida State game where it's just a complete cupcake every year. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of excitement around that. And oftentimes the opener, everybody's excited for it. But, you know, last year we had Miami, but oftentimes that one's not real exciting either. You don't have any of that this year, right? I mean, the first game this year, you're going to have to be ready to go right from the jump. And so that's exciting. The downside is that this was the year where Florida had a favorable SEC schedule and a favorable overall schedule. And Georgia, quite honestly, had a much more difficult schedule. And that's one of the reasons why I think people were picking Florida to be able to potentially get to a playoff and at least win the East. Doesn't mean they can't still win the East. Obviously, you want to go through the best when you're the best. But this one had a little bit more the schedule was an opportunity for Florida. And now that probably isn't going to be the case anymore because, you know, games against Eastern Washington and you know, whoever going to be replaced by games potentially with Alabama and Texas A&M or somebody like that. And if that's the case, we're going to get two more good games, which is fantastic. But obviously, it makes the road to Atlanta a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, that's part of it, Will. We still don't know the two opponents, of course, the next two. A lot of people speculated last week that it would be Alabama, Texas A&M, just because that was the next two non-permanent West opponents that Florida would face in 2021-2022. That was something Ross Dellinger kind of just threw out there. A lot of people took it and ran with it. It still could be that. We don't know. It still could turn out to be that way, but he did admit he was just spitballing there and it kind of went crazy. So the SEC, he later tweeted that they're going to try and use some kind of strength of schedule model. And I was like, look, I tweeted it out there. There needs to be some kind of transparency when you start talking about strength of schedule, because first of all, who determines that? What are they going by? It probably won't matter because there won't be full stands. There won't be fans in the stands and the stadium won't be full, but who gets home, who gets away and why that's the case when you figure out these opponents. So there's still a lot to figure out, but Will, that's the first thing I said. Hey, look, if you're giving strength to schedule, because look, LSU is not the same LSU as last year. Every team is different, but you know, are you giving LSU the easier or harder schedule harder schedule because they were supposedly the number one team in the conference because they won the national championship last year? But well, that's not the same team. So you know, I find something, there needs to be some transparency when the SEC announces this, hopefully. And I texted Peter Burns of the SEC network when this thing dropped. I said, hey, look, you have got to do some kind of like 2-hour program of where you just release the schedule. Don't make us wait. Go ahead and give that to us at the beginning of the show. But then the next 2 hours, you can break down, you know, what the schedules mean. But there needs to be some kind of special programming from the SEC network and giving us the schedule. But with that, there needs to be, okay, here's how we came up with it. And this is how we got to that point.
Yeah, so I volunteered on Twitter for Peter to come on and talk on that show, but I haven't heard back yet. So we'll have to get a campaign going. But no, I mean, I'm surprised they haven't done this similar to like the NBA lottery. Yeah. You figure you'd have it like be a selection show. And I mean, the SEC is great at making money off of everything. You figure this would be an opportunity for them to do that. I think the biggest thing is transparency matters in some capacity, but really what's going to matter is whether the athletic directors are happy with it, right? So if the Georgia athletic director comes out and complains, then everybody's going to know that there was some horse trading going on. And if, you know, if everybody's pretty quiet and they all go out and say, hey, this is the hand we were dealt and we're excited about the schedule, then you know that there was a little bit of give and take. I mean, I think the biggest thing is when you start thinking about the schedule is – you know, the idea that Georgia and Florida probably aren't going to be playing in Jacksonville. That maybe is one of the areas where the negotiation really starts to take hold, because are you going to play in a fanless stadium in Athens this year and then be back in Jacksonville next year? Or do you go to Gainesville next year? How does that work? Those sorts of things where there's special rivalries, special things that are going on are probably the things that are taking a little bit more time. Again, if you're not just going to do a lottery, doing the next two in the rotation makes the most sense. Obviously, that's going to impact some people more than others. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, it was always going to impact some people more than others just because it's two more SEC games. And if it's replacing two non-conference cupcakes, then it's a big deal. If it's replacing, you know, and Alabama was playing USC, right? So so if Alabama ends up getting Kentucky, obviously their schedule is easier than it would have been had they had to go all the way out to California and play Southern Cal. So I think there's a little bit of at the end of the day, you know, when you play in the SEC that you're going to have to beat a tough schedule. And all this does is sort of expand that. So I do think that probably one of the things we need to think about is that this is not going to be a one loss and you're out type of endeavor, right? There are going to be times where teams get caught, you know, a week after a big win, or, you know, maybe one team's coming off a bye and another one isn't, where all of a sudden you get caught and you lose. And it wouldn't surprise me if you had a team that's 8-2 or a team that's even 7-3 that ends up winning, you know, ends up being number one or number two in the SEC and then ends up going to Atlanta. And then that's the other thing is, are they going to keep the divisions, or are they going to have one big conference where they just take the top two?
They said divisions, but I even know, like, do they redesign the divisions for 1 year maybe?
Sure. I mean, so who knows, right? I mean, we're speculating, and tomorrow they'll announce it and it'll all be out there. But like you said, the SEC tends to do things bigger. They have their own network. We're all starved for sports content. And so anything they can do to make this more like a selection show, I'm in favor of.
Yeah. And I threw the question out there on Facebook Twitter last week of asking the fans who they wanted the two conference opponents to be. And I'll even admit, and Will kind of said it as well, you know, just going by the next two is probably the most non-biased way of doing it. Sorry, it works out, you know, Florida and Alabama. But I think that, you know, that's where a lot of the fan angst come from. It wasn't that Florida had to play maybe or possibly had to play Alabama and Texas A&M. It's just that Georgia drew Arkansas and Mississippi State at the same time. So it was, you know, it wasn't, hey, look, we'd be excited to have to play Alabama and Texas A&M. You know, you look for these big games, and that's where, you know, every year I say that I don't care for the cupcake games. I'm more of a, I want to go 9-10 conference games anyway, just because I like seeing good football being played. So that's where a lot of it come from. It's just, you wanted a little bit of equality. Well, first of all, the schedule's never equal. You know, as we said, Florida had a little bit of an easier path. That's what we saw this year compared to Georgia, who had to play Alabama and Auburn this year. Asking the fans out there, Alabama and A&M were still popular since that was kind of thrown out there. Auburn again, just because, you know, old-time rivalry. Florida doesn't play Auburn much anymore. It would be nice to maybe play him again. Another one, of course, Will. The one of the more popular ones out there is Arkansas, because you would get Kyle Trask versus Felipe Franks more than likely if you had that. Now, and I brought this up, you know, does travel distance play a part in how they do this schedule? You know, does it make sense for Arkansas and Florida to travel to one of each other's stadiums? You know, pretty far distance there. But, you know, LSU's already traveling to Florida and all that kind of stuff. So that's probably a small factor. You got to factor in Missouri and all that too. But for storyline purposes, Will, I mean, you know, Florida, Mississippi State, of course, just played a couple years ago in Dan Mullen's first year as Florida head coach. You could get that game again with Mike Leach leading the Bulldogs. Felipe Franks in Arkansas, of course, would be one of the better storylines in college football the week that they played. But yeah, you know, if it's Bama A&M, it's just Bama A&M, and it's just the way it plays out. I don't think it will play that way. I think Florida will get one of those two teams, and then probably somebody like Mississippi State or an Arkansas. And look, that kind of replaces the difficulty of FSU right there. You know, that if you want to look at maybe how the schedule would compare to before, you maybe get a school that's kind of on par with what FSU would have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, the schedule was always going to be more equal or more fair if you go to 10 teams, just because you're playing 10 teams out of a 14 team league instead of 8 teams out of a 14 team league. Right. And what that's really done is it's brought Florida and Georgia's schedule much more closer in alignment in terms of the difficulty, just because of that very nature. Right. So whether it ends up being Alabama and Arkansas, whether it ends up being Alabama A&M, whether it ends up being Auburn and Mississippi State, you know, I don't know that it really matters. What really matters is that we always talk about the SEC schedule being a gauntlet. That's one of the reasons why they don't want to go to 9 games. Well, now they're going to 10. So we're going to see the attrition and the depth, I think, is going to start to play a role more so than a 12 game schedule where, you know, middle of the second quarter, it's already, you know, 24-0 and you've got reserves coming in, rotating in, and you don't really have to go full bore the entire game. You know, this is something where you're going to have to be fully locked in every week when you go out there. And, you know, even in the SEC with some of the teams that aren't as good, you know, they're not pushovers like playing Eastern Washington or North Texas or teams like that. Right. And so that's not going to be there. So I think depth is going to be more important. And that's maybe one of the concerns that you'd have with Florida when you look at some of its contemporaries, you know, Georgia, Alabama, LSU, maybe not so much this year, but just the depth that they have in the team and can they afford to lose a guy or two at key positions, because it's going to be a much more physical time. And then when you combine that with the fact that a lot of these guys haven't been able to spend as much time in the weight room, are they really going to be ready with a 6-week camp, getting ready for the season, all that sort of stuff? Those are the things where I think we start to maybe get a little bit of angst. But, you know, I am not going to complain about the schedule. It is what it is, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic. Yep. They're doing the best they can. At the end of the day, you have to add 2 games. If you add 2 games that are considered not as difficult, then all you'll hear is complaining about it from Georgia. Give me Alabama. Give me A&M. Let's run the table, and then we don't have to worry about it.
And I threw that out there. You know, everybody likes to say this year that, oh, whoever wins the national championship team or this year will have an asterisk by their name. Maybe so. But you could have an asterisk by your name because you just played a heck of a schedule. I mean, say you do start this and teams don't get, you know, decimated by COVID and you play a 10-game SEC schedule. You play a 10-game SEC schedule and then go on to win a national championship. That's a feat. So if you want to put an asterisk beside Florida or Georgia or Alabama or whoever wins it just because, oh, they won it in a COVID year, well, you know what? In a way, that could speak more than just to any other regular season because, like, as you said, Will, and everything you just laid out, playing 10 SEC teams is not going to be easy.
No, and I mean, that'll actually be the really interesting thing, right? Is let's say you've got a 7-3 team that goes to the SEC title game and wins it. Yeah. And now an 8-3 team from the SEC is playing, you know, Clemson, because Clemson hasn't played anybody. And, you know, you're playing, I mean, what does that look like? I think if nothing else, it sort of finally proves the point, really puts the nail and really puts the dagger in the coffin there for conference supremacy. If an 8-3 SEC team comes in and beats an undefeated Clemson or an undefeated Notre Dame, or, you know, assume if the Pac-12 decides to play and they participate, you know, USC or somebody like that. Yes, then there's going to be the opportunity to prove something that you couldn't prove before. And more than anything, like, sports is about seeing things you haven't seen before. And it's about, you know, sort of those special type of circumstances. And obviously nobody wants a pandemic, but in the pandemic, you're doing the best that you can. You're in the strongest conference in the country by far, you know, by all the different metrics, and you just got 2 more games. The only thing there is the wear and tear on your body, and that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why they're not pushing things off until spring. I think they would push things off until spring if they thought they were able to do it, but just from the standpoint of wear and tear, they're not going to be able to do it. And so this is the compromise, and I don't think that, I think we'll put an asterisk by it because we will all remember it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think 20 years from now anybody's going to say that was an illegitimate championship. I think what they're going to say is that was a weird season, but, you know, look at that gauntlet. And I think maybe we'll even learn something, right? I mean, if you think about when the XFL started, everybody kind of thought it was a joke. You know, the first XFL, everybody thought it was a joke. But, you know, we got innovations from that particular league that have carried and sustained its way through both professional and college football. So the biggest one is the floating camera behind the line of scrimmage, right? I mean, that's something that is now just an indelible mark of every football broadcast, and it comes because the XFL was trying it out. So I think there will probably be some things that they try out that they go, ooh, we don't want to do that. But I think there are going to be some things that they see. I mean, you know, if the SEC network wants to maximize dollars, 10 conference games probably beats 8 conference games and a couple of cupcakes. Yep. And the question is going to be, is that going to be a model moving forward? Well, we're going to get to see what it looks like. And so, you know, this is a unique year, a special year, but I don't think it diminishes what the players have accomplished. And, you know, you mentioned if they run the table without having a COVID outbreak, but what if a team does have a COVID outbreak and still manages yep. to run the table? Then they've dealt with a kind of adversity no one's had to deal with before. So in that case, again, I think you look back and say, you know, not only was it a special season, but it was something where they had to overcome something that other people have never had to do.
And something else they got to overcome, Will, is the Southeastern Conference announcing on Tuesday adjusted dates for preseason football activities for the SEC schools, with the first allowable practice now scheduled for August 17th. We were supposed to, you know, fall camp was supposed to start this coming up week. That's now no longer going to happen. The new SEC calendar provides student athletes with more days off than required by the NCAA and fewer practices than permitted by current NCAA rules. This is all, you know, for helping protect the players there. So the new preseason calendar was developed based on recommendations of the SEC's Return to Activity and Medical Guidance Task Force. Last week, the SEC announced its intentions to begin the 2020 season on September 26th. As it continues to monitor developments around COVID-19, the original start date of September 5th would have allowed for preseason football practice to begin on August 7th. And so we thought that was still going to be the case until the SEC announced that. So in the revised SEC preseason football calendar, from August 7th through the 16th, schools are permitted to conduct up to 14 hours per week of strength and conditioning, meetings and walkthroughs, beginning August 17th. And until the opening game, schools are allowed 25 practices with a limited of 20 hours per week of practice time. A 5-day acclimation period is required, with 2 days in helmets only, 2 days in shells, and the 5th day in full pads. Schools would be required to provide student athletes a minimum of 2 days off each week until the week before the first game of the season. So, well, of course, this comes and bears the question, how does this help or hurt Florida? How does that, you know, help or hurt the SEC, other schools out there? Well, I think, you know, before we heard this, we just assumed that all these teams were going to be able to practice starting this week, and that would help make up for a lot of time they missed in the spring. And you know, some you have an extra 10 days here to have some things figured out. So teams like LSU, who's replacing a lot, and Georgia, who's replacing a lot, and you know, potential quarterback battle going on there now. So, you know, now you know, the calendar kind of gets smushed again, and you have to come up with another plan, another adjustment. But then they're used to that kind of by now. But they were getting ready to hit the field, getting ready to hit fall camp, and now this comes up. And they probably had some kind of inclination that this was going to happen. You know, these things just don't happen on a whim. But, you know, it does bear the question, you know, how does this help or hurt Florida and some of the other SEC schools out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the time we've thought that the extra time off or the extra time away from the field has probably aided Florida just because they're bringing back an awful lot of experience. But at some point, you know, I'm not sure that it necessarily matters, right? Yeah. I mean, when everything gets shifted and shifted and shifted, is it really – is anything really getting to the point where it's an advantage to anyone? I think it's a question of handling adversity. And maybe you'd say a team with a bunch of upperclassmen is going to be able to handle adversity a little bit better. At the same time, does this give guys who are relatively new, early enrollees, guys like that, time to learn the offense in ways that they normally wouldn't have the ability to do, right? That the installs would be happening this week. The season obviously would be starting a month from now. And it would be, you wouldn't have had time to do all of the film study that you're now going to have an opportunity to do. I think the biggest thing is I'm just glad it feels like the Southeastern Conference is looking out for its players, at least from a health and safety perspective. My biggest concern with all of this, I mean, COVID is obviously one of the concerns, but I do think that they're probably going to get the best health care that they possibly can get while they're on campus. And so you know, obviously you don't want anybody to get the virus, but if they do, they're going to have great health care if they do. But one of the big concern, well, the secondary concern is just, you know, injuries, like the soft tissue injuries, the ACLs, the Achilles, and then hamstrings and things like that. I think that's probably the thing that, you know, the 2 days a week in shells and then only 1 day a week in pads, those things start to at least allow the players to start to acclimate maybe a little bit better. But, you know, we'll see week one. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think we'll need to be on the lookout for is some of those soft tissue injuries in week one and see whether the layoff has had an impact. I mean, we've seen it in the NBA a little bit. You know, Jonathan Isaac tore his ACL. There was somebody else, I can't remember who it was, got injured today and is going to be out for a little while. So, you know, those sorts of injuries have happened as people have had layoffs. The question is it the layoff or is it just sort of bad luck? I don't know that we'll necessarily know that, but that is one of the things I think that they're trying to mitigate by having some, by pushing back practice and having some of the time limitations.
Well, Will, you know, hopefully all this, we'll have a schedule announcement soon, and a season, and all this can go hand in hand with the announcement from the SEC on fall camp and recent happenings on social media. So, you know, this could be a crazy, unpredictable type of season. And look, it could look much different than the, you know, than we think. If social media interaction is any indication here, of course, you go back a couple of days, Kadarius Toney and Jacob Copeland turned some heads a couple of days ago on Twitter when, you know, Toney tweeted opting out just might be the better decision. And then fellow wide receiver Jacob Copeland responded, quote, thinking it over, you honestly might be right. And then he later tweeted, quote, health over football. So, you know, Brett McMurphy, today, the NCAA comes out and says, you know, and he tweeted this, Brett McMurphy, the NCAA says all student athletes must be allowed to opt out of participation due to concerns about contracting COVID-19. If so, scholarship commitment must be honored by university. SEC already had that in play. But he also says, also, schools may not require student athletes to waive their legal rights regarding COVID-19. And this is also on the heels of some Pac-12 players coming together and listing demands related to health and safety, monetary income, racial injustice out there. Some Big Ten players also came out with a similar list of demands today on Wednesday after the Big Ten announced their schedule plan. So, and Gators defensive lineman Zach Carter got into it with some fans when he reposted in support of the Pac-12 over the weekend. You know, and a very small part of the fan base took it too far with what was said towards Carter. And hey, look, it's okay to disagree. You don't have to verbally attack the players out there that, you know, you supposedly cheer for at the same time in the season. And you know, that was part of Carter's argument there. You know, they're part of a labor workforce that they see in their eyes for these college football players. You know, they want to be seen as more than just a labor of college football, and they want to say in how everything is being handled. So, you know, his back and forth, Will, wasn't so much opting out for the season, but, you know, but the inequality he sees as a player. So, well, just a lot going on. We started this episode here, you know, talking about on the field and schedules and all that. But, you know, just on the other side of this, are players worried about their safety with these schedules getting announced?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so I guess there's a bunch of different issues you brought up there. The first one is guys opting out. If they want to opt out because of COVID, they should do that. Yep. And I'm glad that the NCAA, kind of late to the party, came in and said we're going to hold everybody to the same standards. But obviously the SEC, I think, has been pretty consistent in terms of making sure that the players who decide to opt out for health and safety reasons are able to do that and able to maintain their scholarship. The thing that they have to weigh, though, is that there's dollars on the back end, right? I mean, if you're a 21-year-old guy who is not draftable next year or is probably like an undrafted free agent, and this was an opportunity to maybe get into the, you know, the second, third, fourth round, well, you're costing yourself millions of dollars by not playing. So there are probably going to be some guys who feel compelled to come in and play, and I think that's maybe one of the things that that is weighing on everybody's mind pretty heavily, right? Is a guy like Kadarius Toney, I don't think he probably gets drafted next year if he sits out this year. And then maybe if he performs really well at the combine, he would get drafted. But I don't think based on his tape, you would look at that and say, yeah, that's somebody who's going to go in the top four or five rounds. He's probably an undrafted free agent. you know, going in. So him sitting out is a decision where he'd be coming back to Florida next year to play after sitting out for a year. And then you're taking a year off of your career in the NFL, right? There's only so many bullets in the holster when you're a player. And, you know, most NFL careers are like 3 years. And a lot of that's because bodies start to break down. And so sacrificing that year, especially in football, becomes pretty problematic. The other side is the pay for play, and that one's a little bit more difficult, because one of the things is when you really think at it, I'm surprised the NCAA hasn't done this yet, which is basically that, you know, the people restricting these guys from getting paid are not necessarily the NCAA, it's the NFL. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the NFL says you got to go play somewhere for 3 years or you got to be out of high school for 3 years before you come and play in our league, which means they don't have a whole lot of options. The only option is the NCAA. Now, obviously, the NCAA makes a lot of money. And some of the name, image, and likeness stuff, I think, has always been kind of ridiculous that these guys can't profit off their own name and their own talents. But that's going to be rectified next year. You know, the idea that you're going to be able to get a 50-50 revenue split or even really any additional payment, it's just not going to happen. And it's not going to happen for a lot of different reasons. The biggest one is that Title IX prevents it from happening based on the way the money exists. So, but there's some things on that Pac-12 list that probably ought to be addressed, particularly when it comes to health and safety. I suspect that universities are really also trying to straddle a line because, let's be honest, with no fans in the stands, their budgets are being strained. And then with uncertainty in terms of what's going to happen in the spring or what's going to happen next year, everybody's sort of looking out for what's going to happen with the budgets. And then there are also increased costs associated with doing all of the testing and all the different things that are involved, as well as the legal things. And this is one of the things where it gets into something I don't know very much about, but players aren't considered employees like they are in the NFL. So the NFL and the NBA, they've collectively bargained what the COVID testing looks like. I don't know what the privacy concerns are for somebody who's not an employee, for somebody who's classified as a student athlete, but I imagine that brings some complications into things as well. So somebody who's a lawyer can probably speak up and give us some information on that on Twitter. But the reality is that there are legal entanglements here that the NCAA probably has to work through and the SEC has to work through. And then you complicate that by the fact that the NCAA is really pretty toothless and the conferences have had to go this alone, which means each conference has different restrictions. Each conference has different plans. Each conference has different testing protocols, which is one of the reasons why they're playing conference only schedules, right? Is they want to be able to control that. So it's just a weird time. I think I don't begrudge any player wanting to make more money. At the same time, there's a reality that I don't think that the NCAA is going to be able to acquiesce to that sort of thing. They begrudgingly acquiesced to the name, image, and likeness, and that was just because they knew they were going to lose in court. I don't think they lose in court if somebody says, you know, if somebody comes and tries to take an antitrust or something, antitrust case against the NCAA, the antitrust case is with the NFL. So I think the players have probably gotten about all they're going to get out of the NCAA in terms of their ability to advertise using their own names and images. And I suspect that that's kind of where we're going to settle. But again, if the players don't feel safe, I'm glad they're giving them the opportunity to sit out. And I hope the SEC does a good job for even those guys who are sort of on the fence, but feel like they need to play because of their future, that they'll do a good job of making sure that as best as can be done, the COVID protocols in place can keep everybody as safe as can be. But obviously we've seen with Major League Baseball recently, that's not a sure thing. You do the best you can, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, I think, you know, the name, image, and likeness would go a long way for these players instead of having to go straight to the conferences and all that and demanding money. But you get that name, image, and likeness, and they can make money off their name. I think that goes a long way. And players being able to help support themselves. I think a little more in the stipend that, you know, could probably be used as well. You know, they do provide a lot of money for these universities in the end. But as Will said, it's difficult, and especially right now in the climate we're in, these athletic departments are losing money right now with games not being played. So demands for money right now from universities are probably not the best look when they're not really making all that money right now either. So
if these guys were going to push for something, it should be capping the incomes of the coaches and the athletic directors and the staff, right? Yep. Like the coaches should have to have the same sort of, I mean, they need to get paid, obviously, but, you know, Dabo Swinney making $9.3 million while his players are getting a stipend, you know, I think if you said, if you put a cap on what guys could make and then told me that, hey, we need this money to support women's sports in Title IX, I'd say, okay, I can buy that. Mm-hmm. You know, but the allocation of the resources to the facilities and the allocation of the resources to the coaches, I think is what irks people the most as you look at it and see, you know, ostensibly the white coach and then all of the African-American players. And it feels like people are being taken advantage of. At the same time, again, I mentioned earlier the article Jordan Doman wrote on my website about, you know, what the basketball players got from the women's side. And I'm sure the football players had an even more luxurious life, but there are an awful lot of benefits to being a player at UF as well. And at a major college football program. So these guys are not, there's a significant amount of money spent on the people there. Now you could argue that they don't have the agency to spend that money. I think that's a different argument, but, you know, at the end of the day, like you said, if the athletic programs are struggling from a financial standpoint and they need to make cuts, they're obviously probably going to, I mean, it's going to be the men's non-revenue sports that end up getting cut. Yep. I think we already saw that. I think Stanford cut mm-hmm. some stuff on the men's side. I think we're going to see more and more of that as things go on. And really the pushing through this season is part of trying to mitigate that as best they can.
And Will, I'm kind of glad you said that. I am more on the player side with some of this stuff and kind of defending about being able to make some money off their name. But I also would like to hear the side of it, of them being, like you say, grateful for what they get. You don't hear that side too often, except for kind of down the road, maybe 5, 10, 15 years down the road, of what the degree did for them and what the exposure of playing for, you know, big time universities did for them after the fact. Yeah, and you know, maybe it, maybe, you know, that's part of it as a college kid. You know, it's a instant gratification kind of what you want. And like I said, I don't blame them for fighting what they believe in, especially on the health side of things. That's not in question. They should be able to do that all day long. You know, the monetary value and the Pac-12, and look, they probably started big, you know, 50%. They knew that probably right away. That was gonna be way too big, and maybe you work your way down. Yeah, that's not. And as far as universities and the money go and coaches' salaries, and some, a lot of that is UAA driven, you know, athletic associations that are kind of just outside of the university as far as funds and money raised and all that stuff goes. And a lot of that goes back into the university. You know, except Florida, the UAA will put money back into the university and help the other students on campus and help the lower income sports and all that. So, you know, it is a question of how do you disperse it with the sports that don't make money. If you're going to start paying players, how does it get dispersed? And Title IX out there as well. It's just a lot of questions, and I know they want something now. This will take forever to get figured out with all the layers that are attached to it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, what you said about players and gratitude, I think is, you know, I think back to me at 18, yeah. 19, 20 years old. In fact, I had an issue at work, you know, early last year, and made me call an old boss and apologize to him, because it was like, wow, I was a pain in the butt back then. You sort of realize that stuff as you get older. And, you know, the other thing is, about 4 or 5 years ago, Northwestern tried to unionize, and the mm-hmm. NCAA was integral to preventing that from happening. And, you know, the players at Northwestern were trying to go through it using the proper channels, and they were relatively nice in terms of what they were asking for, and they got shut down. And I think now the players see an opportunity to push in, because of a lot of different things, right? I mean, the weakness of the financial position of many of these universities obviously means that the money is being counted in a way that maybe it wasn't before. At the same time, the reliance of the universities on the football revenue makes them maybe be in a position where these players have more leverage. They sense they have more leverage, and, you know, in times past, they haven't necessarily had that kind of leverage and haven't been able to push things through. Now they see they have a little bit of leverage. It's time to push through. At the end of the day, though, this is going to be a lot like, you know, some of the people who sacrificed in the past for progress. Those people usually don't see the benefits. The people who see the benefits are the people who come after them, who get to enjoy the spoils. It's the people who speak up who typically don't end up getting it. And that's kind of what you're alluding to. It's going to take some years to figure this out. You're not going to be able to switch. You're not just going to be able to flip a switch. And really, universities are going to have to make a choice, because if they're taking federal dollars, they have to have matching scholarship numbers for the most part on the women's and the men's side. And so they're going to have to make difficult choices about what they do want to fund and what they don't want to fund if one of the things they choose to fund is sharing revenue with the players.
And then, look, I definitely won't blame the players for opting out in the name of health. You know, there's still so much we don't know about COVID, especially long term. And we're not going to know that until, you know, months and years down the road here. And I don't like the saying, well, they're 18 to 22 year old kids. They won't die. Is it really just about death? I mean, is that really it? I mean, there's reports of heart and lung damage from COVID out there. And are you really going to keep 18 to 22 year old kids from hanging out and seeing friends and family, you know, 4 or 5 months and they don't get paid? And good luck with that. So, you know, and what about coaching staffs, referees, support staff, everybody who it takes to put a game on? You're putting their health at risk at the same time. It's not just the 18 to 22 year old players. So, you know, it's not just people who fall into that young age range. So, you know, all right, there's no easy answers here. I don't blame players for looking out for themselves here and their families. Now, you hope if they opt out, they're doing it for the right reasons. They're getting the right info and they're taking care of themselves. I mean, and that they can also do the things they need to do to get ready for next season if they decide to opt out. But, you know, if they don't want to play, support that decision. And that's about my soapbox moment right there, Will.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you want to support the guys no matter what they decide to do, you know, and I think everybody has a different risk tolerance. Right. One of the things that's been difficult in terms of getting back to society is that you've got people who have very, very low risk tolerances in terms of their exposure, and many of them for good reason. Right. I mean, if you live with your grandma, then you've got a very different risk tolerance than if you're 24 years old and you live by yourself. But going back to society means meeting in the middle somewhere. And what we're really arguing about is where are we meeting in the middle of that risk profile? Are we meeting more towards the staying indoors? Or are we meeting more in the staying outdoors? And, you know, you know, we're seeing that right now play out live with the NBA and Major League Baseball, right? I mean, Major League Baseball decided that in order to play, they had to be in outdoor stadiums, and that's required them being with travel, and they've had some outbreaks. And then you look at the NBA, they've decided to sit in a bubble, and that's been the way they've been able to do it. So I think there, like you said, there is no right answer. But at the same time, and really it sucks, right? But at some point we have to reintegrate into society. People are going to do that at their own pace and what they're comfortable with. And I think we have to support everybody as they do that, while also recognizing that the people who do want to reintegrate into society need to be allowed to do that as well.
Will, and kind of, you know, to kind of introduce this segment here, going back to, you know, Kadarius Toney and Jacob Copeland, maybe talking about opting out is the way to go here, man. How different would this Gator team look without those two guys? We talked about the wide receiver position, and while Florida lost so much to the NFL draft last season, they also bring a lot back. But also that was due to Kadarius Toney and Jacob Copeland having some experience and bringing what they have back. You lose those two guys, and the wide receiver core looks a whole lot different, and you're having to rely on redshirt freshman Jamarcus Weston and Trent Whittemore a bit more, true freshman Xavier Henderson and Jaquavion Frazier's, who would have to come in and have to be impacts right away in some form or fashion. If, you know, Kadarius Toney and Jacob Copeland, if you can take their social media interactions serious here and they're seriously thinking about it, you know, you got to look at what this wide receiver core would look like.
Yeah, well, not only do you have those wide receivers coming back and, you know, not only do you end up with the lack of depth there, but you also end up with no preparation time, right? I mean, you've got your limited practice that we talked about earlier, and then game one, you're hitting the ground running, right? I mean, all of a sudden you're playing at Tennessee, or you're playing, you know, maybe at Alabama, depending upon what happens with the state, with the schedule. And, you know, so a guy like Jaquavion Frazier is going out there for his first game, you know, first real action where he's being relied on, and he's going to be relied on heavily in an SEC game. So yeah, it's going to throw people for a loop. And then the other thing is that, you know, there's a ripple effect. So when Toney and Copeland go out, then that means you got to pull guys up from special teams who would normally be major contributors on special teams. And now they're major contributors on the offense, which means you got to find more contributors on special teams. And so that sort of ripple effect in the depth, you know, we talked about that a little bit earlier too, that the depth becomes really important because you're going to have to get more from a different subset of people. So, yeah, I mean, here's the reality, right? Is if either one of those guys had gone down with an injury, we would have looked at that and said, that's really a place where Florida probably can't afford an injury. If both of them decide to opt out, then yeah, obviously it impacts things significantly, just not only from having to get the new guys acclimated, but also getting Kyle Trask acclimated to the new guys, as opposed to the people he's been preparing to play with now for, you know, 12 months.
Yep. So definitely something to look forward to and look out for, Will, is players opting out. And we'll get into it later, but, you know, even some guys who could opt out just for NFL draft reasons, and probably couldn't blame them in that regard either. So, Will, before we move on, Clippers and Nuggets.
Who cares?
I ain't talking about the NBA. I'm talking about Manscaped, Will. And you're here to make sure your Nuggets get taken care of in that matchup. Manscaped's here to provide you the best tools for your grooming experience. You can never go wrong with the Lawnmower 3.0, the best hygiene tool for the modern man. Because of their ceramic blade and skin-safe technology, your snags will be reduced. Manscaped just released their Shears 2.0 nail kit, which is a perfect add on their Lawnmower 3.0 trimmer. The Perfect Package 3.0 comes with a new and improved lawnmower, waterproof cordless body trimmer, performance boxer briefs, and a travel bag for you to use when we're all done with this quarantine. The Perfect Package 3.0 also comes with the Crop Preserver and Crop Reviver. The Crop Preserver is the anti-chafing ball deodorant, and the Crop Reviver is made with soothing aloe and which rich hazel extracts that will give your man area a boost. Get 20% off your order plus free shipping with code GATORS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off your entire order plus free shipping with code GATORS at manscaped.com. I wasn't talking NBA, Will. Was not talking NBA.
You got me, Dave. I didn't know where you were going. I should have seen it from a mile away, but it's been a long day.
Anytime the episode starts with the Manscaped read, you know it's coming somewhere along the way.
Well, it's a good product. You had it sent my way. I've been very impressed. So, you know, everybody should go out there and give it a look.
Give that summer body a good look, Will.
Well, they got to be careful, man. If people don't support you, you're going to have to do like a live demo or something. So if you don't want to see that, make sure you go out and check out their website.
Do not want to see that. You do not want to see that. My farmer's tan might blind you.
I thought you spent the whole week in your backyard going down the slide, man. That should be taken care of now.
I did, but the wife is a skin cancer nurse, so she takes very good care with the sunblock and making sure a shirt is worn most of the time. So the farmer's tan is alive and well.
Yikes! All right, next segment.
Next segment, of course, recruiting. Will, always popular segment here. Some good, some bad. Maybe coming up here for the Gators. First, let's go back a little bit, and we'll dive into a player. Look, we go from players that we thought we may see this season, and that may end up not playing. If you can take Kadarius Toney and Jacob Copeland's Twitter conversations serious here. And we now go to a player that unexpectedly will be a Gator and on campus in a couple of weeks, according to him, Will. And one of Florida's top commits for the 2021 class is cornerback Kamar Wilcox. And he says he will reclassify and arrive on campus in the next couple of weeks. You don't see this too often, but with COVID out there and the question of if high school football will even be played this fall, Wilcox sees more value in going on ahead and getting started with his college career, Will. As he said in numerous interviews, he might as well go ahead and get acclimated to the college game, especially if there's no high school football. Go ahead and get on campus and get the playbook. Learn from Marco Wilson. Learn from Kyer Elam. And get around these coaches and get going. So, you know, if a season is played, you know, play in four games this season and still get redshirted, or maybe he can prove himself and be on the field a bit more, you know, in that outside cornerback role as a reserve there. So, you know, but get the weight room, get that taken care of instead of waiting around to see if high school football season will be played. So, Will, it's a welcome in to a roller coaster of recruiting from Kamar Wilcoxon, a player who committed to Florida twice before committing to Tennessee. That didn't last too long before he recommitted to Florida. So after all that, Will ends up coming in a year early. So, you know, that's a really good example of the wild and wacky world of recruiting.
Yeah, so this is his final answer. He decided to come into Florida early. It's an interesting approach. I mean, I understand why he would want to come in early because of all the things you said, right? Getting in the weight room, understanding the program, learning from the guys who are already there, those sorts of things. But he is walking into some pretty stiff competition. I mean, Jahari Rogers, mm-hmm. And Ethan Pouncey are both top 200 guys. So Jahari Rogers was ranked 87th last year. Coming in. So it's not as though he's going to be competing against, it's not like Florida was in need of a cornerback when you think about what they, to be honest, Florida could use help at safety, right? And Wilcoxon sort of profiles there. So the reality is I'm not sure that you can ever have enough defensive backs, particularly when you think about some of the guys that Florida lost. I mean, you know, they're gonna have to replace CJ Henderson. They had some issues at safety last year, and so bringing in more competition is always good. But like you said, this will be one of the interesting things because, you know, you got the 10 SEC games and you're gonna get to play in four SEC games. Yeah. if you're redshirting, and that means you're getting real playing time, right? Like you're not going in when it's 45-0. I mean, maybe you are. I mean, maybe that's when they wait until you play, you know, somebody like Arkansas or something like that. And you're up big, but
Tennessee.
Yeah. So, but you know, Georgia, but the reality is, you know, you're going to be out there with guys who are at least equivalent to you in talent every time you go out there. So I think it'll be more of a learning experience for these guys. And again, I go back to what I said earlier about, if you're going to have to manage playing a sport through the pandemic, the healthcare at the University of Florida is going to be better than anything you get through a high school. And the testing at the University of Florida is going to be better than anything that you would get at a high school. And that's not a shot at a high school. It's just the reality of the fact that Florida has more resources and has more control over what's going on within its particular sphere. And so, yeah, I mean, if you're concerned at all about the pandemic, I think the place you'd want to be is college if you were deciding between high school and college. So beyond maybe just getting rid of the uncertainty and getting in and getting some extra reps and sort of getting started early, I do think this is, you know, this is driven also by some of the uncertainty associated with high school, and Wilcoxon obviously a welcome addition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So welcome news there. And kind of been on the back burner for a couple of weeks. It's been out there a little bit, and it kind of comes to fruition. You know, it's still got to happen, but everybody says, or he says, he'll be on campus in a couple of weeks. So let's go back to a week ago. Will, I was on vacation last week, so I didn't spend too much time on the commitment of Desmond Watson, the 6'6", 350-pound defensive tackle from Sefner, Florida. Andrew Ivins for 24/7 Sports offers an analysis and a comparison to former Alabama defensive lineman Terrence Cody. So, quote, he says, a large, wide hip body that's well over 350 pounds, surprisingly light on his feet given build and composition, oftentimes one of the first to pounce off the snap and initiate contact. Quick hands and swim move allow him to get past blockers and make plays in the backfield, eats blocks, and effective at times against double teams. Will, however, need to drop some bad weight and lean out in college, which should happen once he's eating at a training table and working with a strength coach. Also needs to improve overall pad level. Has the looks of an ideal nose tackle for a 3-4 defense and should be able to develop into a multi-year contributor for a Power 5 program. So kind of mentioned last week, you know, many out there consider Watson to be one of those, you know, big-time underrated three-star recruits out there. He dominated camp circuits before COVID, was really rated high. Something interesting here, Will, you know, he was really rated high by 24/7 Sports in his initial ranking with a grade of 94.18. I went back and looked. Right now, that would be good for a four-star ranking and the 127th best player in the country on 24/7 Sports. So that's for their composite for the 2021 class. Right now, the composite has him graded as a 3-star, 88.91. So about a 4-point drop and the 354th best player in the country. So that would be a drop from about 127th best player to the 354th best player in the country. The composite has him as the 21st best defensive tackle in the country. 24/7 Sports Soul Rankings has him as the 457th best player in the country and 30th defensive tackle. Where his composite score goes up, Will, is in his rivals ranking. His rivals list him as a 4-star, 18th best defensive tackle in the country, and ESPN also lists him as a 4-star. So little difference there's a little difference in the services between 24/7 rivals and ESPN. About the only knock on him is his weight, but that's going to help him be the type of player Florida wants him to be. You know, Florida doesn't have or hasn't had the type of player that he is at defensive tackle. He can shed some weight, of course, that was mentioned, and put on some more muscle, but you want that guy to be the big plug in the middle, and it can also get into the backfield. So, you know, you pair that with four defensive linemen that Florida has committed right now, Tyreek Sapp. Hopefully the Gators can keep him committed there. Defensive end Justice Boone and Christopher Thomas as well, with Watson. So, you know, Sapp, Boone can play inside and out, but mostly strong side defensive end position. Thomas can play inside pass rusher with some quickness there. So Watson's a good complement to those guys, Will. 6'6", 350, play over the center as a true nose tackle. And Watson will be able to take on some double teams and plug the hole and free up some others along the defensive line.
Yeah, I mean, in a 3-4 defense, obviously, that's really important to be able to do that. I think anytime you're getting compared to Terrence Cody, that's probably a good thing. And if weight's the problem, just get him next to Ethan White, and that should all be taken care of, because obviously White did a really nice job last year of taking off the weight and getting ready and getting out there on the field. I think the interesting thing is you get a guy who's 6'6", 350, and then you put him next to a guy like Gervon Dexter, who's listed, you know, at 6'6 and a half, 286. And you sort of can envision the type of defensive front that Florida had with Dominique Easley and Sharif Floyd. Obviously, those guys were both much higher ranked than Watson. But at the same time, I mean, that's really what you're looking for, is you need a guy who can take up a double team and can get push up the middle. And then you need a guy who's fast and can sort of has that fast first step. And I think we have that with Dexter. So, you know, again, you want to pile up guys up front to build depth. Watson's a really good player. People are going to look at it and go, oh, a 3-star, but he's 354. You mentioned he was ranked much, much higher earlier in the process. COVID makes these rankings, I mean, as much as I subscribe to them, does make them a little bit goofy, because you haven't had the opportunity to do the same kind of camps and analysis and sort of set the final setting. And then the other thing is, from the standpoint of making it to the NFL, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between a guy ranked 100th and a guy ranked 300th. I think at the end of the day, that's where the coaching starts to really become a major deal. I think if you got a bunch of 5-star guys, you know, you don't need to do a whole lot of coaching. You put them out there, and on their athletic ability, they're able to make it to the NFL. It's when you get to the guys who sort of jump around from, you know, 120th to 250th, and then they drop down to 350, and then they go back up to 289. It's like, okay, that's the guy where, you know, clearly there is some, there's some variability within those ranges, and Watson right now, they just happen to have on the low end of those ranges. So, I suspect that based on what people have talked about in terms of his ability to dominate some of these camps, that had he had an opportunity to play his senior year, maybe he still does, but you know, if he has an opportunity to play, he's probably going to climb up those charts. But again, big bodies on the inside, those guys are hard to rank, right? I mean, if you're trying to rank them next to a running back, I feel like the running back's always going to get ranked higher, just because the space eater isn't the guy who gets the glory. But let's be honest, those are the guys that you need. You need guys in the trenches, and you're not always going to get 5-star guys. Obviously, you want them, but you're not always going to get them. And this is a very solid addition for Florida.
Yep. And where I want to go back and look at the 2020 class as well, and add all that to the 2020 class. You know, this includes 5-star Gervon Dexter, Antoine Powell, Princely Umemilin, defensive tackles Lamar Goods and Jalen Lee. So, you know, I like to make up with the reputation of Dan Mullen-led teams always being strong on the defensive front, a good starting point for years to come. You know, if history is any indication of the development they'll get with David Turner and Todd Grantham. So, of course, the big news this week, Will, and we'll wrap up the episode here, the commitments of the Palmetto kids. Maybe the not-so-good news part of recruiting here. So you guys have heard me talk about the Miami Palmetto group for months now, and their commitments are coming up. Defensive lineman Leonard Taylor, thought to be a long-time Florida lean, will commit on Thursday, August 6th. So today, for many of you out there, if you listen to the podcast version, looks to be choosing Miami with all the recent intel, if that's to be believed out there. Safety Corey Collier will be deciding on August 10th. Gators look to be in good shape there, but still have to fend off LSU and Miami. We'll see where that one goes. And then Jason Marshall might be committing any day now. Another one that many had, a Florida lean, that now looks like he may go elsewhere to either Miami or Alabama. Miami looks to be in the lead there for his services. So, well, I mean, look, some of these, losing some of these guys will obviously sting, especially, you know, if we're to believe that the Gators were in great shape for a long while with these guys. Also sting because you'd be losing out on some really sought after players. You know, this isn't just losing out on highly ranked players. We talk recruiting rankings and all that, but you know, these are players this Florida staff has put a lot of time and effort into. So, you know, this staff wants these guys, guys they've identified to be high level players and near the top of their own personal board. So, you know, it stinks because, you know, whichever players decide to go elsewhere, you know, it's high level in-state talent choosing to go elsewhere. And this time it may not be recruiting juggernauts, Alabama, Georgia, Clemson, Ohio State. It would be Miami, an in-state team you're better than. You beat them on the field last year, and a team, that's a team that's hot on the trail right now. And these kids are in Miami's backyard. And, you know, but this is a Miami team that went 6-7 last season with losses to Florida, and then later on to FIU and shut out against Louisiana Tech in a bowl game. Yet they're being able to sell their program to these kids. And is COVID a reason? It certainly could be, probably is. But Miami's putting themselves in position to, you know, to be in the mix here, and many predicting that they'll be the choice for Taylor and Marshall coming up. So, you know, and I keep seeing, and I put this out on Twitter, you know, wait till the games are played. Well, they were last season, and that's not really hurting Miami on the trail right now. Coming up, we'll see how it all plays out. Now, maybe they'll stink it up again, and if these guys commit to Miami, then they'll maybe they reconsider a commitment to Florida later on down the road. But you know, but then, you know, Miami can play the tone of come play early, and this is why we need players like you. So we'll see how it all plays out. You know, decisions haven't been made yet. That's just the way everybody's hearing and leaning right now. These kids still have a decision to make, but it's not looking good on the Gator side. You know, hopefully some trolling going on out there, and the Gators end up with them. But look, I put this out there on Twitter last week. Dan Mullen will win games. He's too good of a coach not to win games. He will, but I have very little doubt of that. But you know, a team like Miami may not win because they you know, if they can't develop these players here. But what if it's these same players that can be the difference for Mullen, and they're wasting away somewhere else? You know, it's these type of players you spend a lot of time on identifying and recruiting as high level players, and that could be the difference from going to 10 and 11 wins to 14, 15 wins. Will?
Yeah, I mean, so I wrote about that earlier this week, just looking at, you know, people keep asking, why is Florida struggling with recruiting? And there are excuses thrown out there about facilities and about spending. And obviously, Georgia's spending a lot more money than Florida on recruiting, but Miami's not. Notre Dame's not. Oklahoma's not. And so it's not just a money thing. I don't think it's just a staff thing either. I mean, I think that there are things the staff could obviously do better. There are things that Mullen could do better when it comes to recruiting, but I don't think it's necessarily just a staff thing. It's certainly not showing it on the field, because the guy's won everywhere he's been, and he's turned the Florida program into something where people are predicting that Florida is going to potentially compete for a playoff this year. So you'd figure that would start to get people to really take notice, and it just hasn't really taken hold. And I think what it really boils down to is sort of what I, you know, in the article I mentioned, that at work, I've got guys that I interface with who are naturally born salesmen, and those guys right now are still killing it. Even though COVID's going on, and even though they got to sit at home, they have relationships with their customers that allow them to call them up and get information and push sales through. And, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, all those sorts of things, right? And they've built those relationships over time. And then you've got guys who that's just a little bit more difficult. They have a different set of skills, right? And it's not that they're bad salesmen. It's just that their skills are not, it's not natural. It doesn't come natural to them. And so now with COVID, what you're finding is that, you know, there are some fissures in the relationships, not necessarily because of their fault, but just because that's the way they kind of operate, and that they don't naturally become best friends with their customers. I think that's kind of what we're seeing now, right? Is that Dan Mullen, I think he's proven thus far in his time at Florida, is not a natural recruiter. He's not somebody who immediately gets along with everybody that comes in the door. It takes a while to get to know him. You got to sort of warm up to him. You know, I quoted a couple of parts from Urban Meyer's book with Buddy Martin, just looking at, you know, Meyer kind of having to recruit people in spite of Mullen, as opposed to recruiting him with Mullen. And you hear a quote like that and go, all right, well, now maybe that's what's going on, right? Is that, and the interesting thing is Meyer talked about everybody loving Mullen when they left. The problem was getting him there so that they could become really good friends with him. And that's kind of what we're running into now, right? Is that I think when you boil down recruiting to Zoom meetings and being on the phone and sort of being a natural when it comes to building relationships, that's not Mullen's strength. And that doesn't mean he's a bad coach. It doesn't mean that Florida needs somebody else. It just means that's kind of the reality. And you look at Manny Diaz, and obviously I think we would all say that Mullen has much more of a track record in terms of success. Even when you look at Diaz's defensive coordinator days, there were some years where he had some pretty bad defenses and sort of bounced around a little bit, but no one has ever questioned his recruiting bona fides or his ability to build relationships. And that's what we're seeing at Miami. So it is what it is. It's kind of where Florida is at this point. I don't think it's going to be repaired by changing people on the staff. I don't think it's going to be repaired by facilities or just dumping money into things. I think it's probably just the reality of things. And the disturbing thing is that when you look at where Florida is, so they're ranked 10th right now, but they have 23 commits. And Miami's right behind them with 20. But if Miami gets the two Palmetto guys, they're going to go flying up past them. Texas is at 12th with 15 commits. Notre Dame is at 13th with 15 commits. Oklahoma is at 14th with 13 commits. Georgia is at 15th with 11 commits. And A&M is at 16th with 13 commits. So all of those teams are likely going to jump in front of Florida. And you're looking at, 16th, 17th in the country nationally, 7th or 8th in the SEC. And, Mullen talks about wanting to win thumb wrestling. If you have a thumb wrestling competition, well, recruiting in the SEC is more important than winning a thumb wrestling match. And so it's going to have to improve. I don't know how you do that though, in a pandemic that really sort of exacerbates maybe one of the things that he's just not natural at.
Yeah. And we'll see, of course, we'll see how everything plays out. One to look for is Tamise Adeleye committed to Ohio State, close to Kamar Wilcox. I don't know if he'll have much say in it, but there's another talk of him maybe reclassifying as well. And if he does reclassify, maybe Florida's in the mix more so than when he committed to Ohio State a few months ago. And look, I'm sure, there'll be some players who shoot up on the board later on in recruitment. Like going into last year, not long before National Signing Day, a lot of us hadn't heard of Princeton Umanmielen, and he ends up a Gator. So you'll have some players who come off the board, go on the board. But, right now the focus is on the Palmetto guys because so much focus was put on them by the coaching staff. We know those were big time targets for the Gators, and we'll see what happens. Corey Collier to safety there, probably the Florida Gators' best chance of getting one from the uncommitted guys, and that the guys that are committing soon, the best chance to end up in orange and blue. So, man, Will, that was a jam-packed episode.
There's a lot going on, man. So, between global pandemics and the floods up here and you trying to trick me about the NBA and our sponsor, I think we did pretty well.
Balls, Will, balls.
Hey, go buy it. I'm telling you, he's gonna get desperate and do a demo for everybody.
There will be none of that.
You can start a Patreon and people have to contribute to prevent the demo from happening.
Reading reaction, I'll let you pop that early in the episode. What's coming up?
Yeah, so we've got another Give Him Hell Pell episode coming up the next day or so, and then I've got some new tools to break down film, and I'm hoping to break those out sometime this weekend. So we'll see what happens at my real job, but I think it'll be good. I think people will enjoy it. It's a good teaching tool to sort of look at the film, break it down, and look at what's actually happening. Mullen did some really interesting things this past year with Kyle Pitts, and I expect he'll be able to do some of that in 2020, and I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, Will sent me a preview of that, so you guys will really, really like what you see there. Some good stuff coming from Will. You've seen, if you've read his articles for the last couple of years, the gifts that he puts on there. Well, this would be a step up in the production for Will and what he's able to provide at Read and Reaction. So you guys will definitely get a kick out of that. You can follow Will on Twitter at Will Miles SEC and his site readandreaction.com. I'm the host of Gators Breakdown, David Waters. You can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. guys and girls out there, thanks for listening to this episode of Gators Breakdown.